Good evening, everyone. Hello, and welcome to CureTalks. I'm Priya Menon, Scientific Media Editor at CureTalks, joining you from India, and I welcome all of you this evening to a discussion on medicine for the mind. This is our 7th episode in our talk series on mindfulness. In the past, we have had numerous experts discuss scientifically proven holistic remedies for a range of health issues. In today's show, we have a very distinguished panel joining us to talk about Tai Chi, yoga, and meditation. Our expert for the day is Dr. Peter Wayne. Dr. Peter Wayne is Assistant Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School. He is a Director of Research for the Osho Center for Integrative Medicine. Peter has more than 35 years of experience in Tai Chi and Qigong and is author of the recently published book, Harvard Medical School Guide to Tai Chi. On panel are Morgan Dix. Morgan has been an intensive student of meditation and yoga for the past 19 years. Morgan is co-founder of the media platform About Meditation, which provides beginning meditators with tools for understanding how to meditate. We also have Dr. Carol Horton joining us again. Carol is the author of Yoga PhD, Integrating the Life of the Mind and the Wisdom of the Body, and co-editor of 21st Century Yoga, Culture, Politics, and Practice. A popular writer and speaker, Carol offers lectures and yoga teacher training units on modern yoga, history, ethics, and culture. She serves as a teacher with Yoga for Recovery, a Chicago nonprofit offering yoga to women in Cook County Jail. My co-host of the evening is CureTalks Creative Director, Aziz Rawat. And today's topic of discussion is mindfulness, being a medicine for the mind. For the listeners, towards the end of the discussion, we will be answering questions sent in via email if our panel has not already addressed them in the course of the discussion. If you want to ask a question live, please press 1 on your keypad to let us know, and we will bring you on air to ask them. With that, it's over to Aziz. Aziz, you're on air.
Thank you, Priya, for all the introductions. Thank you all for your time. We have an excellent panel here, and we have a great topic today, which is relevant and urgent. Our times are packed with so much of stress and fast food and so little time and physical activity that it's taking a toll on our minds, bodies, and overall health. And we know pills and surgeries are not the solution, and we need a tectonic shift in our thinking and approach to health. There are many scientifically proven holistic approaches that can help us. But it's a pity that these approaches, most people don't know about these approaches, and they're not backed by big advertising dollars, so nobody hears of them, and those who hear about it, they don't know how to go, don't have a clue as to what to do. So having said that, I would like to kick off this discussion by asking some questions from Dr. Wayne. Dr. Wayne, when people think of martial arts, they think of self-defense, combat, Bruce Lee, and things like that. Can you talk to us a bit about Tai Chi being a medicine for good health, and how did this form of combat reform itself to become a healing art?
Well, thank you for the question. And before I start, I want to say thank you so much for including me in this very rich discussion and a timely one as well. I think your question's a really good one. And it would be difficult to talk at length about the history of Tai Chi. But Tai Chi is a meditation in motion. As a martial art, it's called it emphasizes what's called intelligent strength as opposed to just pure physical muscular and skeletal strength. And in that sense, not only is it a physical exercise, which we know has health benefits, but it's focused on heightened body awareness, focused attention of the mind, balance, and softness in terms of borrowing strength from the partner have attributes that are really important to health. And many of these attributes of focused attention, relaxation, body awareness are very common and parallel to the modalities that our other guests are going to speak about, including yoga and meditation. So it was natural for people who were practicing the martial arts of Tai Chi to experience the health benefits. And then as it became more popular, not only used for self-defense in military settings historically, the general population started using it as a health benefit. And that has really evolved quite a bit as it's migrated to the West and other cultures.
I see. So it's more of, it's so much of inward-looking thing that you have to experience yourself so much that it kind of leads to a self-awareness sort of thing.
Yes. And even in the martial arts phrasing, they say know yourself better than your partner knows you. So there's a lot of self-exploration and discovery involved in these Eastern martial arts.
Okay, I see. Okay, so, and like in today's fast-paced life, how can Tai Chi fit in my schedule? So what is the minimum hours of practice one would need to feel the benefits of Tai Chi? And if there is a time of day that's best, what would that be?
It's a logical question, but I think I'm going to answer it a little bit with a common sense answer. One of my teachers would say, you know, if you were asked how much do you have to practice piano to play, the answer would be contingent on whether you wanted to play in Carnegie Hall or whether you wanted to play after dinner for your guests. So the amount of effort that you put into it depends on what your goals are. People who practice a little bit, you know, a few times a week for a few minutes at a time can gain quite a few benefits. It's the same with meditation. There's some simple breathing techniques and focusing that if you add it to your daily routine, can enhance your overall quality of life, and you can even integrate it with the other exercises or activities you do. But if you're really looking at finding a tool that can help with a serious health issue, that's a chronic issue, then the investment that's needed is much greater. I think that's obvious. So there is no one real number, but the short answer would be a little bit every day is better than none, or better than a lot at one point in time. And the question as to what time of day is better, for most of my students, any time of day is better than not doing it at all. However, there are some discussions about the value of doing your practice when you wake up in the morning, much like meditation, because in Chinese medicine, they believe the body has gone through a process of balancing during the sleep cycle. And it's a good time to take advantage of that. And also you set the tone for the day. So if you come out of the gate with some practice and meditation and centering, you feel good, and it's much easier to carry that through the rest of the day than maybe just doing it in the evening after you've accumulated a lot of stress for the day and you're just trying to shake that off.
So is this something that you could do? For example, you can't give like a full stretch of, say, 1 hour to it. So could you just do it in bits and pieces all throughout the day like that? Is that possible?
Again, I would make the analogy to some of the other practices that our other speakers are going to address, which is if you have a strong meditation practice that you've cultivated for a long time and you do have the skill to focus your attention and your breath, then it becomes easier to intermittently add a few minutes here and there and do short spouts. But in the training where you're developing those skills, it could take longer periods of time. So in our studies at the Harvard Medical School, we typically ask patients, and many of them come with serious illnesses, to come to class for 1 hour, two times a week, and then to practice at home for another 30 minutes, as many other days as they can, if not every day. So that's our prescription within a clinical trial. Some people do a little less, some people do more.
Okay. And actually, I would put across to Morgan and Carol as well in their discipline, as in I would like them to pitch in here as well in terms of meditation and yoga. You know, what is your take on this. Morgan, maybe you can start first, and then we can go to Carol, and then we can circle back to Dr. Wayne again.
Sure, Aziz. Thank you very much. And also, just before I answer the question, it's a pleasure and an honor to be here again, and also with Peter and Carol. So thank you very much. And in response to the question of how much, I think really, as Peter alluded to, it's very similar with meditation. When I'm working with new meditators, I put a lot of emphasis on consistency versus duration. So I try to help people establish a habit early on. So I put a little less emphasis on you should do 20 minutes every morning or 10 minutes. I often just say, just pick a number. And if it's 2 minutes or it's 5 minutes, pick a number and then commit. And then build from there. But I think it's important for people to develop a habit of sitting down, focusing their awareness in meditation, and then when they get accustomed to it and familiar with it and they get the swing of it, they can begin to add time and start to reap some of the deeper benefits from the practice. Otherwise, I think, especially for Westerners, meditation is still, even as popular as it's becoming, it's still a relatively foreign practice, and it's just new, and a lot of people aren't so comfortable at first doing it. So I think of it as a very gradual process of becoming comfortable with it, accustomed to the practice, and then over time, they develop the habit, then they really start to experience some of these benefits.
Yeah, that's a good point about establishing a habit, and that kind of, when you do that, it's basically you are gradually moving into a certain change of lifestyle, which is
absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Good point. Okay, Carol, do you have anything to add to this from a yoga standpoint?
Thank you for having me on the show again. Honored to be here. In terms of times of day to practice yoga, I would say that any time except soon after you've eaten, ideally you should wait maybe 2 or 3 hours after eating a meal to practice yoga, since you will be moving and twisting your body a lot, or right before bed. I'd say any other times are fine. I find if I do yoga too close to bedtime, a more energizing practice can keep me awake. So unless you're doing something that's really geared to help you sleep, I would do it not right before bed or right after meals. In terms of the practicalities of getting started, most yoga classes are offered at gyms or yoga studios, and they tend to be an hour or an hour and a half in length. I would say the ideal would be to find a good yoga studio that offers an intro class that's 90 minutes in length. That's not available everywhere and may not be something that people can fit into their schedule, but that, to my mind, would be a great way to get started. If not, going to an hour-long class that you can fit in at your gym, there can be very good classes at gyms. You really have to find a class that works for you on a holistic level that feels safe for your body, and that also has benefits that you can feel in terms of something that's maybe a little more than just exercise, makes you feel calmer and more centered, less stressed, whatever. If it feels good to you, then keep going with it, and see if you can perhaps start adding in something really simple at home just to start feeling comfortable with the home practice. So maybe just pick a really common pose like downward facing dog and try practicing that every day for 5 minutes. And then I would say gradually build up from there. So if you can add a second class during the week, that's great. Have two actual classes with a teacher watching you and instructing you, and add on a little more time at home until ideally you build up to 5, 6, 7 day a week practice, either through classes or at home.
Mm-hmm. And then and then coming to a point where you can do a lot of it as home practice on your own, and then maybe just going for some classes to the studio. Is that how you would think like the progression would be?
I feel that developing a home practice is really key to having something that becomes a part of the fabric of your life and really is deeply empowering. However, I know from experience that for most people it takes a while for them to get to that point, and classes are easier, so it kind of depends on what works for the individual. But ideally, moving towards a home practice to me is what you need. But that said, I think even for someone who's a yoga teacher or very experienced, it's very good to go to a class with a teacher that you feel you can learn something from, because everyone teaches in different ways. Everyone has something different to offer, and there's so many different styles of yoga. So we always want to keep learning and stay with that beginner's mind.
I see. Yeah. And from all the three of the, like, all, you know, from Tai Chi to yoga to meditation, the one common thread that I'm getting is that you got to be prepared to work on the lifestyle part. You have to bring this into your lifestyle. That's what I'm getting, a common thread in all three answers here.
For sure.
And moving on, Dr. Wayne, back to you. If you could name three top conditions that Tai Chi could help correct, what would those be?
Well, I think there's some very good research. So I wear two hats here. One is as a scientist who studies the medical benefits of Tai Chi, and the other as a practitioner, and I've had my own experiences with health and my students. But I'll wear my scientist hat for now and just say that many people will be surprised at how much research has gone on in terms of the health benefits of Tai Chi. We monitor the medical literature, and in the English language alone, there are probably well over 1,000 peer-reviewed scientific medical articles. So within that large pool of information, there's a number of conditions that sort of emerge to the top that the evidence is quite strong and unequivocal. I'd say the first one has to do with postural balance and prevention of falls. There's quite a bit of strong research to support that as an upright, moving sort of meditative art, Tai Chi improves your balance, improves your stability, your resilience to unsteady environments, and particularly in older people where falls are a serious health issue and can cause a lot of suffering, if not death. It's remarkable what the studies show, and some of the better ones in older people suggest that Tai Chi can reduce the risk of falling by 40 or sometimes more percent. So that's one of the areas where there's very strong data that I feel quite confident about. The second condition, which is a little surprising, has to do with cardiovascular health. We have a notion of exercise being something that you really got to give it 110% and sweat on the treadmill and really push it. And that's not accessible to many people with heart failure, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or deconditioned. And so we've explored the heart health benefits of this slow-moving exercise, and we've seen some very nice improvements in people with chronic heart failure, in pulmonary disease, and other conditions where their exercise capacity and a number of other risk factors for cardiovascular health events are improved. And I would say the last area, which is one of the areas that we're studying as well, has to do with cognitive function or mental health. Thinking about cognitive function in particular, memory and executive function, that part of thinking that regulates multitasking and helps moderate all the other aspects of cognitive function. There's some very nice data that's emerging to support that. Particularly as we age, we all know that we begin to lose some of our mental faculties, and Tai Chi may retard the rate of cognitive function loss. And even in people with mild cognitive impairments, some moderate dementia, Tai Chi seems to improve some of those cognitive abilities. So those would be the first three that come to mind, but there are obviously, pretty much any condition, there's some research, but those are my top three.
Okay. So from a condition standpoint, cardiovascular, cognitive, and postural balance and prevention of fall. That's really interesting. As in cardiovascular, I wouldn't really think about Tai Chi so much because, see, you know, in my head, I think cardiovascular is okay, running and, you know, doing a lot of sweating it out. But that's a really good piece of information there. Okay, so the next question is about the philosophy of integrative medicine is to treat the entire person and not just the disease. Now, and integrative medicine, Tai Chi, and holistic healing is still a niche approach, at least it is in the West. Do you see a conflict with the current mainstream antibiotics and disease-focused approach? Do you see the two approach? How do you see those two approaches coexisting in the mind of the patient? Because that's, you know, that's something that a patient who knows this part of medicine and, but, you know, you have got the mainstream, and how does a patient deal with that?
That's a really interesting question. And I would say, I think historically, and maybe in many conservative environments, there is a great emphasis on thinking of health and the human body as a pieces of machine that are quite separated. So we go to the foot doctor for our foot and the hip doctor for our hip and the head doctor for headaches. And very few traditionally trained physicians think of the whole system and how all these pieces are interconnected. But I think more and more, even in the environments that I work in at the Harvard Medical School, there's a great appreciation of things like the mind-body connection and how mental thoughts and beliefs and stress can affect the immune system and how the immune system can affect inflammation and how those can affect the joints. So I think increasingly Western or conventional medicine is starting to see the body as a complex system where the parts are all highly interdependent. In fact, at the Harvard Medical School, there are whole new programs training physicians and doing research called systems biology. And many of the fundamental thoughts in systems biology are very similar to the thoughts of traditional Chinese medicine or the philosophies that really believe of the strong interdependence of mind and body and breath and spirit to some degree as well and is showing up in our medical school curricula as well. So I do think historically there was much more of a difference than there is now. And I think in many ways patients are looking for remedies that see them as a whole person and help them reintegrate their parts. And their doctors are learning as well as they are that this is an important new framework. And I think things are evolving, and I think that practices like meditation, like yoga, like Tai Chi are catalyzing medical thinking and research in this area is actually really starting to penetrate the medical literature and fundamentally changing how we think about the biology of the human condition. So it's a very exciting time. I think there's a lot of crosstalk and learning from one another going on. And the Osher Center for Integrative Medicine is one of a number of centers in the country that really specialize on in that bridging of ideas.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. And so you did touch upon this point earlier about, Tai Chi helping with the cognitive aspect of, our body and mind. There was one article that I was reading which talks about Tai Chi making your brain bigger, as in literally bigger. As in, is that literally possible? And the other second part to it is Alzheimer's is a big thing in the U.S. Do you see any success for people with Alzheimer's practicing Tai Chi?
Those are great questions, and I'd love to hear what some of the other panelists have to say, Carol and Morgan, because there's quite a bit of research from multiple mind-body practices, Tai Chi, meditation and yoga that look at the impact on the brain. In terms of the brain getting bigger, there's a couple studies that suggest that the gray matter volume of the brain increases. Similarly, in very nice meditation studies conducted at the Harvard Medical School, there's been demonstrated changes in what's called cortical thickness, that part of the brain that's involved in higher order thinking. So there's also some nice studies from meditation, not so much from Tai Chi, that shows that the part of the brain that's involved in memory, the hippocampus, can get preserved if people practice these mind-body exercises. And as I mentioned before, some of these studies of Tai Chi are done specifically in people with mild levels of what we might call Alzheimer's, what's called mild cognitive impairment, or MCI. And they've benefited in terms of their mental function and their overall quality of life. So I think that there's very compelling evidence to suggest this is something to pursue further. A big part of the research we're currently pursuing right now is to look at preservation of mental function in Parkinson's disease, where the focus typically is on tremors and movement, but we also see that there's big changes going on in cognitive function. And I think one of the key exciting areas is we now know that how you think, your cognitive function, has a huge impact on your balance and movement, and how well you move and exercise and your mobility and agility seems to directly impact your cognitive function. So again, back to that systems biology, mind and body are really interdependent, and now the psychologists and psychiatrists have to collaborate with all the movement disorder people because they're not separate issues.
We are living in a pretty interesting time where all these things are coming. And you, every day you hear something or the other about, you know, how new things are being discovered about the brain and how, you know, like the whole neuroscience and things like that. So, yeah, this is, we are definitely living in very interesting times, as you said. Okay, moving on to meditation. Morgan, so I have a few questions for you. If you were to give me a quick to-do 1-3 list to get started on meditation, what would that be?
Okay, so I'll give you a really pragmatic response to this. And again, this is really designed to help someone create a durable habit. So it's a kind of a quick 5-point list of. I would say the first thing is to pick a time each day that you want to meditate. So if it's in the morning, say I'm going to meditate at 7 a.m. every morning. Then, as we were speaking about before, you should really decide in advance how long are you going to sit in meditation. And you want to start with something attainable that's not going to put you off. So it's really important not to overreach. If you're new to meditation, I wouldn't start with 30 minutes. I would start with something simple like just a few minutes, 5 to 10 minutes. And because I feel consistency is more important than duration. And then I would say the third point, give yourself a month. Make a commitment to meditate every day for 1 month. You need also, this is the fourth point, you need a quiet place to do it. And like when you're creating a habit, repetition and cues and having a place to do it, these are all really important factors. So pick the same place, pick the same time, commit, and lastly, I would just start with a very simple focused awareness technique like counting your breath. So when you start, and I think that's one of the simplest but yet most powerful focused awareness practices you can do. You just focus on your breath and you count. And anyone who's done a little bit of meditation knows your mind's going to wander, and that's not a problem at all. You just keep bringing your attention back to counting your breath. You count to 10, start over again, and that would be it. Then you're meditating.
is when you count, the counting means inhaling and exhaling as one, or does that matter?
Yeah, you do like a whole cycle, an inhalation and exhalation, and that would be one count. Exactly.
So meditation for stress reduction has been widely talked about. But what about people with conditions such as depression? Including depression such as, caused by chemical imbalances like bipolar or manic depression and schizophrenia. Can meditation help that?
Personally, I have to admit, this is really not my area of expertise. I don't have a lot of experience with that. I know there was a study, researchers from Toronto and Exeter in the UK, they recently found that learning mindfulness while tapering off antidepressants was as effective as remaining on meditation, and this is for people who suffer from recurring depression. So it looks like there is some research out there that supports that. Maybe Peter and Carol would be able to speak to that better than I would. But I would recommend a brilliant author, Ruby Wax, who is a stand-up comedian, but a cultural critic, I would say, from the UK. She just wrote a great book called Say New World, and she has struggled with depression for a long time, and she wrote this book about her struggle with depression and how she really manages it with mindfulness. And in response to her condition, she went and she got a degree, a master's degree at Oxford in mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, and she's started to learn about the science behind it. And she really takes you through the science in her book, but she does it with through the lens of a comedian. So she brings a very light touch to it, but she doesn't shy away from a lot of the real issues, some of the prejudice she experienced as being someone who suffered from depression. But she also helps you understand mindfulness was really and has been one of the main ways that she manages it. And this book, it's a great resource, has a lot of the science in it, and I recommend it. It's called Sane New World, and her name is Ruby Wax.
Do you say Change New World?
Sane, as in sanity.
Oh, sane. Okay, sane. Sane New World. Mm-hmm. Okay, then the next question is about, meditation. From the outside, when you look a meditating body, you feel like nothing is happening. Like you see, somebody sitting, crossed leg, closed eyes, doing nothing. But of course, that's not true. Can you expound on that a little bit and the various aspects of meditation in a way that what's the body going through and what's going on, what's it's experiencing, and things that we don't see or experience as watching from the outside?
Sure. So. So just to focus the question a little more, I see. So you're questioning what is the process of meditation, what's happening?
Yeah, what's happening to the body, the mind, while, in a meditating body.
Okay. So just start a little bit so let's imagine, I like to use like a fitness center metaphor. So one way to think about meditation is that you're training your awareness or your attention when you meditate. So just like when we go to the gym to exercise our body and develop our muscles, meditation is really, it's one powerful way that we can train and refine the quality of our attention. So if you sit down to meditate, you usually have an object of your meditation. Let's say, like we were talking about before, that it's your breath. You're focusing on counting your breath. So when you're sitting there and you're quietly counting your breath, that's the equivalent of doing for your attention or your awareness what, say, squats would do for your legs. So because your mind is conditioned to wander, it doesn't naturally stay on that single object of focus. So when you sit there quietly and you're making the effort to relax and to be very still and bring your attention back to the object of your meditation, you're working that muscle of attention. So if you sit there, say, for an hour, you may end up bringing your attention back to that object of your attention 100 times or 500 times. It's the same thing. You're building that muscle of attention, and in the process, you're slowly exercising it. So that's one thing that's happening. But something else is happening, which is the more you relax and focus and you keep bringing your mind back, you begin to experience a sense of singularity. So distractions fall away, and you begin to find yourself calmly abiding in a different part of yourself where you're not touched by the distractions. Your attention becomes very focused, and focused not in a tense way. And it's here you start to see that you start to make an important distinction, that your mind and thoughts are different from your attention, so that they're two very different, although intimately related, phenomena. And so the reason that's important is because mostly we assume that we are what we think. But meditation helps you create distance between you and your mind, between you and your thought stream. Mm-hmm. So that's beneficial on a lot of levels, because most of us, we have a reactive relationship to everything that happens in our head. So meditation enables you to change that relationship to your mind. So instead of reactivity, there's space, there's focus, there's perspective, there's relaxation. And you do that through building that muscle. So that takes a lot of practice, but that's some of what's happening when you sit there. And then you basically find out that there's much more to you, to who you are, than what you think. And then if you look at it then from what you were saying, the neuroscience, I think there's a lot of studies now. I mean, they're proliferating, that shows that when you're doing what we just talked about, it lights up different parts of your brain, like Peter referred to, the hippocampus, which is associated with self-awareness, compassion, introspection. And I know in terms of, I'm aware of some studies, there was in 2011 a study at Harvard that showed 8 weeks of MBSR, mindfulness-based stress reduction. That I think was a pretty landmark study, and it showed significant increases in the gray matter in that region of the brain, in the hippocampus. And I think that's just the beginning. Like, another study showed the anterior cingulate cortex, which is associated with self-regulation, that's another region of the brain profoundly enhanced by meditation. So there's a lot going on. There's the neuroscience, but then there's also the training of your attention.
Uh-huh. Well, it was really nice for you to like describe in words as to what is going through the body, because, you know, people who are not doing meditation, but, you know, they kind of want some sort of a picture as to what it is, it feels like, at least in words, I think. And that was, I think, we got a pretty nice picture of that, what you told us.
Great.
So,
great.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah, thanks for that.
Great.
Do you believe there are conditions that, and this was a question that, you know, I asked Dr. Wayne as well. Do you believe that there are conditions that that people take antibiotics for that can be resolved by meditation? And what would those be if, you know, there were some conditions? And I'm guessing maybe it's something similar to Tai Chi, which is also a form of meditation, I would say, but yeah. Maybe you have a different take on it.
I have no idea. It's completely out of my realm of expertise. Mm-hmm. I think Peter Carroll may be able to speak to that more than I would.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Moving on to Carroll. Carroll, it's very interesting, and I'm very curious. Tell us a bit about teaching yoga in jail and homeless shelters. How is it different from teaching in a usual studio? What are your students' expectations from you, and what are your expectations from your students there? And is there a difference you see in them or yourself when you are conducting these classes? Talk to us a little bit about that.
Sure. It's a type of yoga teaching that is very dear to my heart. I truly enjoy doing it. Some of the differences teaching in a jail or a homeless shelter versus a studio would be, first, the actual space is not going to be nearly as nice. I mean, a studio is very much set up to provide the physical space that enhances and supports the kind of calming and centering experience that we are practicing with yoga, whereas if you go into a jail, you have to make do with whatever is available. So sometimes there's rooms that are okay. Sometimes you're in the corner of a big, noisy gym. You really have to be very adaptable. The type of student who will be there is quite different in the sense that, on the whole, yoga is still primarily a more white, college-educated female demographic in the United States in terms of who's going to classes at studios. So if you go into a jail or a homeless shelter, obviously tends to be more lower income, more people of color. I have only taught women. There are classes for men as well in Chicago at Cook County, which are taught by men. Those students tend to have had little, if any, exposure to yoga before, so they really don't have expectations about what it will be, in the same way that someone who goes to a studio might come in knowing that I want X or Y. These students tend not to have expectations. This is something fairly foreign to them usually. The classes I've taught are all voluntary, so the students are just there because they are given the option and they choose to go. So they're already doing something kind of brave in terms of trying something that's foreign. And I find that a big difference with the type of student I'd get at the jail versus studio would be that if they arrive at class and they make the decision to open themselves up to participating in it, I'd say there's a sense that I have that they more quickly get into a really deeper part of the experience in terms of the mindful, centering, self-aware components of the practice than I would find in a studio. Some people, once they arrive in class, they're nervous and they hold back and they keep themselves separate from it, but they know they're doing that. Most of the people who are there and they decide to do it, or you see them evolve from holding back to getting in, there's a real sense of, it's almost like, I think of it as maybe providing water to plants that have been experiencing a drought for a long time. I think that these people are just so starved of the opportunity to really engage in holistic self-care and have the time and space to feel safe and to touch in with themselves on a deeper level and be encouraged to cultivate positive dimensions of life, such as peace and equanimity and so on. It's very rare. So I think there's a sense of people that I have of them kind of drinking it up in a way that is profound. And I think in a studio setting, you have more people are sort of they're there for their own reasons, and they don't necessarily have that same pressing need to take care of themselves deeply that someone who knows they're in a really bad situation, if they make the decision to take this class, they often want to make full use of that opportunity. So that makes it a very satisfying place to teach. And then the way you would teach is a bit different. There's actually a kind of loose set of methods that's emerged under the term trauma-sensitive yoga that's well known among people who teach in these more non-traditional settings. And the trauma piece of it ties into two ideas. One, if you go and teach somewhere like a jail or a homeless shelter, you're likely to have a class of students who have collectively a much higher level of intense trauma in their lives. Not to say that trauma isn't in the general population, it would show up at a studio, but a higher concentration. And so therefore, when you teach the class, there's certain adjustments that you would make to try and make it as therapeutic as possible for people who've experienced trauma. And there's also a lot of research going on about how yoga can be healing for post-traumatic stress. And it's actually being used in veterans' hospitals in the U.S. as well and adopted by the military. So you teach a little different, more mindful, more gentle, more cueing in terms of choice for the students rather than, say, asking them to close your eyes and do this. Just providing a little more choice. If you're comfortable closing your eyes, please do so. If not, just let your gaze be soft so that people feel a sense of having permission to connect with and work with their minds and bodies in ways that feel safe at all times. We also wouldn't touch students without a prior for adjustments and so on, as you might have in a yoga class to help guide the body into the pose. You wouldn't do that unless you had training of the correct sort and a long relationship with this group of students. Otherwise, like at the jail, we just have a no-touch policy.
I see.
Yeah.
Well, there was one thing, and I was trying, to get the answer to a lot of things and all that you said was great. One thing that I really latched onto was when you said, like, you gave a complete picture to me when you said, like, water to a starved plant. That kind of really brought the entire picture in my head as to how what's the difference that you see in students, and that was really well said. All right, so moving on. So there are, different forms of yoga, from hatha to vinyasa, and, the list goes on. So, and some of them are meditative, some are more physical. What forms of yoga would you recommend to someone who is interested in making some changes and leading a more joyful, depression-free kind of life? So it's not, it's not going doing yoga for, it's more of a mental, I would say, and, just having a joyful life and not so much about physical. What would your advice would be for that?
Well, I don't think there's any one-size-fits-all answer. I think the reason so many styles of yoga have developed is because people at different personalities, stages of their life, levels of comfort with working with their minds and bodies respond better to different types of techniques. So there is kind of a process of just trying things out that I think students need to go through to find what works for them. But I would say, in terms of general guidelines, one is that I strongly believe that the more deeply effective yoga classes offer an integration of mind, movement, and breath in a more conscious and explicit way. So some yoga classes or methods, really you're only being cued or taught to do physical movements, and there's not really any instruction on how to work with your breath. And I would say that kind of class is unlikely to help you access the more holistic benefits of the practice is one where you're also being taught how to work with your breathing and how to work with your attention and mental focus, because the sort of practices that Morgan talked about in terms of focused attention or another form of meditation is open monitoring. Those are the same sort of things that one can work with in the context of a movement-based yoga practice, and that makes it a very multidimensional and rich practice. And someone suffering from depression can then start to have insight into some of the deeper causes of the depression over time. There's a lot of emotional release that often happens for people in yoga that brings insight, that also just lets go of some of the feeling. Also, certain poses are known to bring more joy and energy. So I would say back bends are often great emotional release poses and energizing poses, also inversions. But really, it's I would say the key is finding something that when you do it, you feel safe, but also you feel this is taking you into new territory that's kind of exciting and different, and that you leave feeling like something has shifted on a more holistic level, that it doesn't just feel just like exercise, pure and simple, and to kind of trust your gut intuition in terms of what will work for you best as far as specific method goes.
And you said that looking for the more holistic yoga studios where you have mind, movement, and breathing, all working together. So that's the kind of yoga that kind of feels more whole or complete.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely.
Okay. And recently, you know, the Indian Prime Minister proposed this Prime Minister's proposal was for celebrating the International Yoga Day, and it got an unprecedented support of the UN, and now we'll be celebrating the first International Yoga Day on June 21st. Yoga definitely has a huge worldwide following, but we never hear, you know, doctors ever prescribing to patients as a solution, you know, yoga as a solution for mental, physical, you know, health. Do you think yoga can ever become a part of the mainstream medical world where you're not prescribing pills, but you're prescribing asanas for getting better, you know? And like to your point about that was to a different context, but you talked about adaptability.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a way to kind of teach yoga or do yoga in which is adaptable? So it's like, you know, taking a pill is like you can put it in your pocket and go anywhere and have it. Whereas yoga, you know, teaching yoga in a way that you can be so, it can be so adaptive that you can be anywhere and do it. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So there were two parts to this question, basically.
Right.
One was, you know, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So one is the adaptability of yoga for particular health conditions, and the other is, could that be integrated into mainstream medicine?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah. So there is a long tradition dating back to the early to mid 20th century in India with the teachings of Krishnamacharya, who really was central in developing the sort of contemporary yoga that is asana or posture practice that we think of as yoga, pure and simple today. And a lot of that lineage, which is still carried forward with the work of people like Gary Krafzow in the United States, is really highly therapeutic and is considered to be best done on an individualized level. So you meet as a student with a teacher by yourself, and the teacher designs a specific program for your needs. And that is done at some studios in Chicago, like Yoga Circle, where I'm taking classes, is a more traditional Iyengar-based studio, and they have gentle yoga classes for people with health conditions, and they basically have enough teacher assistants in there, so each person gets a specialized sequence for what they need. It's written down on a card and kept in a file. And it's a fantastic way to really hone in on healing modalities that are going to work effectively for you as an individual. So there is a long tradition of that. It's not what people normally think of when they think of as yoga, but it is out there. And you can probably find it, particularly if you're in an urban area where there's more yoga. Like I said, we do have that available in Chicago. In terms of integrating it into mainstream medicine, I just happened to finish reading the book Healing Yoga by a Dr. Lauren Fishman, who's in New York, who does exactly that. He's a medical doctor, has done yoga for many decades, was a BKS Iyengar student, and he explains in the book a little bit about how over time he started integrating yoga into his medical practice and actually prescribing it for patients in this one-on-one individualized way, looking at what they needed, trying this, trying that, see what would work. And then from there, he's honed some general recommendations that work. So if you have this sort of back pain, then those sorts of postures done regularly usually work. And he recently published a paper about how for the treatment of scoliosis, doing a very common yoga pose called side plank, on the weak side of the back, with the side that would be, I forget if it's concave or convex down, but with the curve of the back, one side is weaker of the muscles. You hold the position. It's basically like taking a push-up position, but then flipping onto your side. So one arm is down and one arm is up, and your body is stacked up vertically. Doing that every day over a period of months for, you know, he's worked with, I think, almost 200 people by now, and it's reduced their curvature of the spine by, you know, 40, 50, 60%. You know, he's had incredible success with this. So will that become more common? I mean, I think that Dr. Wayne's comments earlier were encouraging, that if it's becoming more acceptable at Harvard, that's going to spread. I am not involved in the medical profession, so it's hard for me to say, but I do think that there's a new generation of young professionals coming into all sorts of fields in medicine, social service, psychotherapy, and so on, who, unlike the older generation, grew up at a time when yoga was common and acceptable. And they've done it since they were kids, lots of them. They may do teacher trainings, even though they never planned to become a full-time yoga teacher. And so then they bring that into their professional work. So I think that because of that generational shift, there's going to be much more integration of yoga and other mind-body therapies into fields like psychotherapy and medicine than there has been in the past.
Yeah. I could add to that and build on Carol's comments if I have a moment.
Sure.
So I think Carol's right on, and the statistics at Harvard are quite remarkable in the sense that of our 12 or so hospitals, just about everyone is offering yoga or mind-body. Physicians themselves are practicing increasingly, but they're also referring. Last month, Morgan and I had an opportunity to meet with the medical school students, and they have yoga clubs and mind-body clubs, and those are going to be our next generation. And in terms of very targeted interventions, one of our research fellows, who's also a high-level yoga practitioner and teacher, did for his fellowship, and he's now funded by NIH, to study the effect, to develop a very specific protocol, which he did with his teachers in India, in the hospitals there, for people who are on dialysis. So every week they have to come three or so times to just sit for hours as their blood gets purified. And what he wanted to know is, I have this captive audience, they're very sick and chronically ill, can we develop a very specific yoga protocol that will be appropriate for that seated position or standard position while you're attached to a machine, but would also address some of the specific health issues with end-stage renal disease. And his first study is quite promising, and in a couple of years we'll have the results of that. But I think increasingly this bridging between traditional approaches and scientific evaluations are going to grow. And I hope someday someone's going to say, take three asanas and call me in the morning or something like that. Same with Tai Chi. And meditation. So I think increasingly this is happening, and I think there's a lot of optimism that we should have for that.
Wow, yeah, that's so interesting. As in, people on dialysis and getting them to do yoga and seeing the benefits of that. Wow, that's pretty amazing. All right, I'm going to open the floor here to anybody else who wants to ask any question. If Morgan, you have any question, or Carol, you have any question for each other, or Dr. Wayne, and then I have like a couple more questions for all of you, actually, all the panelists, and then I'll hand it over to Priya, and then we can take it from there.
Great. This is Morgan. I'd love to just ask, a simple question to Peter. Peter, I've been reading your book, The Harvard Medical School Guide to Tai Chi. I love it, and I'm learning a lot. And I wondered if you could talk for us a little bit just about the idea or concept of qi itself. You mentioned in your book that it's a difficult term to define, in as much as there's really no direct corollary term in the West for it. We have, with yoga, we have prana, which can be kind of a close approximation, maybe. And then in the book, you use the terms to describe it: vital energy, information, breath, spirit. I was particularly struck and compelled by your use of the term information when describing qi. And can you say a little bit, can you just speak about this generally, and what is qi? And can you say a little bit more about what you mean when you say that it's information?
Well, that's a really rich and challenging question, Morgan, but thanks. I'll give it a shot. I do think that there are parallels in all our traditions, and I think prana, and in the Judeo-Christian tradition, they talk about pneuma. It's cited in the Bible regularly. There's something that animates things. There's something that's not necessarily tangible, but it's what makes it all work. And there was a translation by the Jesuits who were intrigued by acupuncture. I believe it was in the late 1700s or early 1800s that translated it as energy vital, or vital energy. And that's something we can grasp. And I think that's one way to describe it. Energy moves things. It animates things, much like breath inspires things. But I think there's a very nice book that will do much more justice to this issue called A Brief History of Qi by a scholar named Huang and Rose, two scholars. And they start off by saying that it's a little bit like the concept of snow to Eskimos. There's probably, 30 or 40 different descriptions of it that capture different aspects of it that are all equally important. But having said that, going back to information, information is what connects things. And thinking about health and the body as a system, as we get older, let's just taking balance since we've talked about it, we know that many things regulate our balance. The strength of the muscles, the effectiveness of how the nerves conduct, our ability to feel the parts of our body and their sensitivity, what's called proprioception. Vision is important. What happens in the inner ear, it's like this internal GPS system. All of those are really important in making this whole system coordinated. And as we age, the sensitivity and level of functioning all go down. So our vision gets a little worse, our muscles might get a little weaker, the sensation in our fingers and toes get worse, the inner ear system gets weaker. And you can think that dampening of information that is fired from all those places and communicates to the other makes us a little weaker. And so in that sense, it's It's the things that connect all the parts. It's the information, it's the richness of the system, it's the complexity of the system that, mm-hmm. that's associated with health. And the more we lose that input, the less complex our system is, the less healthy it is. And you might say that qi has an analogy to that. And this comes from the book that I mentioned before. They talk about tang qi. And colloquially, that means let's stay together. Let's stay in touch. And that idea that qi is the connector. Sometimes people say that breath is the connector, because in some practices, breath is used to connect the body and the mind. It's that go-between. But I think more generally, information is a good tool. And what I like about it as a scientist, but also being trained initially before doing medicine as an ecologist, is that it's measurable. And so in our research at the Harvard Medical School, we've been studying the aging process and how things like Tai Chi and other mind-body practices influence that. And we can measure the complexity of heart rate, can measure the complexity of balance dynamics. And what's really nice is that these provide indices of health that are, you need to collaborate with mathematicians and physicists to calculate these things. But we can measure the dynamics of these systems, and they give us a really nice sense of health. And what we're finding is that people who do these practices have higher complexity than people that don't. And if we take people who are quite ill and we expose them to these practices, the richness of the system, the crosstalk between all the different systems in the body goes up. And it's a really nice metaphor for holism. And for that reason, I like information and I like these quantitative tools as opposed to just studying output from one system like the immune system or something like that. So that's a long-winded way of getting to it, but it's about the whole connectedness of the system, and the level of connectedness is a level of information, higher information.
Long-winded but beautiful, and really illuminated the whole idea for me. And the primary transmission or concept that comes across to me when you talk about it is really the profound intelligence of the system. I mean,
yeah.
When you talk about qi that way.
Yes, and I think all of us who do these practices and read the rich traditions, there's this hard to grasp thing, the inner wisdom of the body. But that inner wisdom doesn't reside in one place. It's a wisdom that emerges out of how all the pieces do or don't connect to each other. So, yeah, I think that wisdom or intelligence is a really good one. And in many ways, when we drop the very logical thinking mind, all of your traditions say, meditation or Tai Chi, it's not what you think, that there's another way of knowing other than the thinking process. And I think that's the intelligence we want to tap into. I imagine when Carol's leading her groups and you're leading your meditation, you're asking people to drop in and to listen to what the whole being is saying. There's an intelligence that wants to be heard and tended to. And so I think that's getting a little closer to this idea of maybe we'll call it qi or information or inner wisdom.
Yeah. And one last thought related to that, Peter. It's very compelling to hear you speak about it, because when I think about what integrative medicine is pushing off against a more reductionistic, atomistic model of treatment and thinking about the body and the system, it's very reductionistic. But when you talk about it, I experience the opposite effect. You feel the promise of medicine it's very dramatic. You think about a problem or an issue or something that needs attention, suddenly the scope of possibilities for how to deal with it, they feel like they really open up.
Yeah, and I'll use that comment to go back to something Aziz was asking everybody. And, he said, when would you, is there a use for yoga or these other practices as an alternative to an antibiotic? I think it's a good question, and everyone asks that. And again, I've been in China and I've gotten really sick, and I can't tell you how grateful I was to take an antibiotic. It really just was
like
a charm, and I prayed to the pharmaceutical companies for, you know, with gratitude. I think it's not for me an either or, and I think, you know, there may be very acute situations, and people are exploring, can you use, you know, mindfulness in the trauma room at a hospital? And yes, if the doctor is calm and focused and you ask people to take a breath and to, you know, to trust what's going on, that's a really acute use of these mind-body practices. But I think the primary benefit is going to be in the long run in terms of prevention and in terms of management of real chronic illnesses. And in those cases, it really isn't an either-or. There's a real good place for medication, and maybe over time people can reduce their doses or reduce the numbers of meds. And in many cases, like in chemotherapy, many of these practices really alleviate the side effects. So I'd love to start, you know, in the spirit of systems thinking and integration, even the distinction between conventional and alternative medicine, it just blurs into one larger, really integrative medicine. And that's the picture I hold.
So, Carol, do you have any questions to ask at all?
Well, listening to this, I was just struck by how much this idea of vital energy or chi or prana resonates with people who do all different types of mind-body practices. When I listen to Dr. Wayne or Morgan talk, even though I've never done Tai Chi, I have done more meditation, I've recognized what they're talking about through my experience with yoga. So there's obviously something really common there. However, as someone who is interested in taking yoga to places like jails and also places like low-income schools, there in those contexts we run up against the cultural problem that you can't use words like chi or prana because they're seen as potentially religious or off-puttingly foreign and kind of threatening. And we don't really have a word in the English language and in American culture that's commonly recognized that refers to this phenomenon we're talking about. And so I feel that we need something equivalent to chi that you could take somewhere like a school and have people understand what it's about without it raising a lot of red flags or questions of, you know, religion and so on that have already come into play with, say, lawsuits being brought out to block yoga being taught in public schools on the grounds that it's a religious practice.
Yeah.
But there's an element of the practice that, you know, goes beyond the kind of more mechanical health and mental health and physical health benefits that we think of. And so that I feel that culturally we need to make some sort of shift to give what we're talking about in our culture more of a place. And I wonder if anyone has any thoughts about if you see that happening or how to do that.
I'd love to respond to that if I could, Carol, because I think it's such an important point. We don't use that word often in our teaching, the word chi, and that's it's an interesting concept, but for the way we teach, we just don't find it necessary, and it's so hard to sort of measure and talk about. What we ask people to do on the first day, whether it's people with trauma or Parkinson's or heart diseases, just come to standing and can you feel your feet on the floor and can you feel how you're breathing and can you feel the connections to your parts? And when you feel these parts, can you be kind and just sort of meet yourself where you are? And I think that just moves people to a wholeness and a certain way of feeling that they don't need a word to call it anything per se. And it's ecumenical. It doesn't scare people. Sometimes we'll use a lot of imagery in our work, and we'll imagine, you know, ask people to imagine they're, you know, on a mountaintop and they're, you know, feel the fresh air and their hands can go over their heads and guide that through their body. And we'll make fun of it. laughter is one of the best bridges between cultures. And some of our veterans in our pulmonary studies with leather jackets and USS something or another hats on, you know, find themselves doing this, and we start laughing about how unusual it is, but it makes them feel good, and then they don't care. And then I think this issue of the name of the practice is unfortunate right now. I think we teach Tai Chi, and I've actually consciously chosen to teach Tai Chi because it's unthreatening. I can do the same exact practices that I do in a class called Qigong, but like yoga and like certain types of meditation, there's a stigma associated with that. And when people think of Tai Chi, it's like, oh, that's what the elderly people do in the park. It's sort of like an exercise with a little mindfulness. It's unthreatening. And unfortunately, I feel like Tai Chi right now is kind of like an ambassador opening up those doors. But over time, I think people will begin to trust that these are independent, that you can be a Christian and practice yoga, and you can do Tai Chi and be a Muslim. It doesn't matter. But unfortunately, right now, there's a lot of learning that has to happen in our culture. But I think that's a really great point you made, Carol.
This is a great discussion, and we have totally gone over our time. I would have loved to talk more and hear you guys talk. You know, there were so many other questions that, you know, come in out in my head, and I would love to ask, but we have totally run out of time. So thank you all once again for your time and all the information you guys provided us today. All of this was very useful and important. I'm sure our listeners will take away a lot from this talk. And thank you all, and I'm going to hand it over to Priya now.
Thank you, Aziz. Dr. Wayne, Carol, Morgan, Aziz, as Aziz said, that was an amazing discussion, so much so that I think we lost a track of time a bit. We're almost 15 minutes over. And I thank all of you for being with us for this extra time. I think most of the questions that were sent in, we have kind of touched upon almost all of them. And a couple of them which we have not, I hope I would just email them to you, and maybe you can just send in a very short answer for those for our listeners. And this show has been recorded, and this broadcast will be made available on the Cure Talks website. Please visit curetalks.com for information on our upcoming shows. With blizzard warning in some parts of the U.S., please stay warm and safe. And thank you so much.
Thank you all.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hope to meet you someday, Carol, and Aziz and Priya.
Likewise.